From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There have been protests across the state in response to anti-government demonstrations in the streets of Iran. California is home to the largest diaspora in the country, with more than 200,000 Iranians calling the Golden State home. And thousands have participated in solidarity demonstrations in cities like Los Angeles, as well as here in the Sacramento area. More than 7,000 miles away, the turmoil in Iran is an escalation of a violent crackdown. Last week, the Iranian government imposed a communication blackout across the country, so we can only get a snapshot of what is unfolding. A conservative estimate is that the number killed in Iran as of today ranges from 600 to more than 1,800, according to different reports, and over 10,000 people have reportedly been arrested. But some outlets, like the BBC, have reported the death toll could already be much higher, with no end in sight. We're going to get a better understanding of what led to this latest push for a regime change and the complexities over what Iran's future could look like. Professor Sahar Razavi is a director of Iranian and Middle Eastern Studies at Sacramento State and joins us now. Welcome back to Insight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's just start with the most pressing matter. What triggered the current protests that are unfolding in Iran?
In late December, there was a sharp devaluation of the currency, the Iranian rial, against the dollar. And this just capped off a long process of devaluation. Inflation has been high. The price of goods has gone up. The price of groceries has gone up 72% just in the last year. So when the currency drops, it reduces purchasing power dramatically. In protest of this drop, shopkeepers, merchants closed their shops and walked out. And after that happened, many groups started to join, but little by little. First students joined, then other civil rights groups joined, and then it started to pull in more and more swaths of society, so that now it's a broad-based uprising with a lot of different interests and a lot of different visions for the future of Iran.
I was reading an article in Time magazine, and they had reported that the currency had dropped to nearly 1.5 million rial to the dollar.
Right. It lost 16% in December alone. I've seen reports of losing between 50 and 84% in 2025. This means that people are simply not able to live. They can't buy the basic necessities of life. When this is happening at the same time that inflation, unemployment, and the price of basic goods are all rising, it creates a very pressurized economic situation, exacerbated both by gross mismanagement domestically and also external pressures like the broad-based economic sanctions led by the United States.
The country is roughly the size of Alaska, and these protests have grown and expanded in just the matter of a couple weeks. How did that evolve in such a relatively short period of time?
It began in the capital, and then within a few days, the more the protests spread and the more they escalated, the more the government pushed back. And it was the pushback that really spurred more and more growth as well. At the same time, we did see, and we have seen, encouragement of the protests from outside forces, including the United States and Israel. And this has a mixed effect on the protesters. There are very strong opinions both inside and outside Iran about what kind of impact that encouragement has had and what kind of role those external forces should play, as well as what kind of outcomes that could have for the movement.
So what I'm hearing from you, has the Iranian government, has there been an evolution in response to the protests and the demonstrations over the last couple weeks?
Yes. The first couple of days, the most immediate response from the government was relatively restrained. They came out and they said, "We hear you. We understand your concerns. We are also feeling the effects of economic pressures because we are just like you." I mean, they tried very hard to take a conciliatory and understanding tone. And in fact, they introduced a subsidy of about, it translates, at direct conversion is $7, but in purchasing power parity, it's about $40 per person, excluding the top 10% of earners. They wanted to ease the pressure a little bit, but this gesture was kind of too little too late, which we've seen before as well. And the more protesters escalated their demands, the more of an existential threat the regime perceived to itself, and the more then they cracked down. Another reason, I think, for the initial kind of reserved tone that they had is that compared with the Woman Life Freedom Movement, which was extremely significant
in 2022.
I was here talking to you about it then. Compared to then, the geopolitical situation in the region has shifted. They had kind of a buffer in their own minds. They had a buffer against potential foreign intervention from the United States, Israel, and U.S. allies in the region because they had the Assad regime in Syria, they had Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they had Hamas and in Palestine. And so with Hezbollah and Hamas significantly weakened, with the Assad regime completely gone, and with Russia bogged down in Ukraine, and they do get a lot of military equipment and supplies from Russia, they were feeling kind of between a rock and a hard place, and they felt that conciliatory gestures were probably safer for them at that time. But as protests have escalated, I think that they've perceived their backs to be against the wall somewhat, and that has spurred this sense that they have to crack down in order to prevent the protests from gaining momentum, even though there is a risk now of foreign intervention escalating because of it.
Yeah, and that crackdown, of course, has become violent. As I mentioned off the top, there's been a communication blackout across the country. So there's an internet, it's difficult to get messages out. It's really difficult for reporters to be there. Right. They're trying to communicate from outside of the country. So when we're talking about these estimates of the number currently killed or people arrested, I mean, how can we be accurate given that we're giving such a narrow snapshot of what's unfolding?
I think it's going to take a lot of time for us to get any accurate numbers, if ever. And to answer the question of how can we be accurate, to be honest, I'm not sure we can at this point. I think we can assume that there have been at least several hundred confirmed deaths, at probably closer to a couple of thousand at this point. And in fact, that's probably an undercount as well, based on the reports that we have. But we also know because of the blackout, we don't have enough reports. In fact, a video clip has circulated both on state media and independent outlets of hundreds of bodies at the morgue in the hospital in body bags. And people were wondering, why is the state media showing this? This doesn't seem to fit their narrative. But in fact, it serves a very effective kind of purpose for the government, because they are trying to deter protesters from joining the demonstrations. They are trying to convey, look, if you come and join these protests, which they have, as usual, dismissed as agitation from foreign elements, then this fate could befall you and your loved ones as well. So we know, whether they like it, the regime likes it or not, we know that many people have been killed. I think we also need to be kind of wary of the function of these kinds of death tolls. Even one is too many. There's not going to be a threshold below which there's no justification for any kind of intervention, and above which we have to intervene. There are so many different factors at play, and I don't think that there's an exact number that we either will get or even that we need in order to know what's happening.
As you mentioned, this isn't the first time in recent years that Iranians have taken to the streets. I mean, when you joined us following the death of Mahsa Amini for not wearing a headscarf, a hijab, that was in 2022. There have been other demonstrations, you know, over the last 20 years, you know, in this century. Are these demonstrations connected, or are they separate individual protests?
I think each uprising is connected because they are outgrowths of people's frustration, dissatisfaction, and discontent. They are connected because they represent not distinct kind of discrete movements, but broad-based coalitions between different segments of society. I don't think that they are coordinated. I don't think they're connected in that sense, but they are, I think, connected in their overall goals and causes. Mm. I also think when we look at each uprising, we see escalations that in some ways respond to the government's response from last time to the protests. And so this time we see very diffuse protests across many different areas, not only within cities, but also across the country. And the Iranians have been very creative about how they are reacting to government surveillance and government violence. And they do this because there's this adaptation between protesters and government, and not just in Iran. This is a dynamic between dissidents or opposition and government all over the world.
And we're talking right now about Iranians in Iran. But of course, there's a large diaspora here in California, including in the Sacramento area. What would you like people to better understand about Iranians and Iranian Americans who live here watching this unfold thousands of miles away?
There are a couple of different things I would want to mention. One is the Iranian diaspora, as far as the breakdown of the proportions of who supports which kind of outlook or regime or government for a post-Islamic Republic government that they may envision, the proportions are different in the diaspora than they are in Iran. And for what it's worth, I think it's important that we integrate diaspora voices, but I do believe truly, because Iranians are the ones who are living under those conditions and who have to deal with the consequences of any internal or external upheavals in the region and in their country. I think we should be centering Iranian voices. Iran is full of very brilliant, inspiring, and visionary leaders, many of them in prison. And I think it's important for us to recognize that Iranians outside of Iran and Iranians inside Iran don't necessarily always align with what they're asking for. That said, I also think it's important, you know, along those lines, for people in the United States, for people outside of Iran, to understand that like Iranians, like any country with a robust civil society and a long history of democratic activism, and Iran has an incredibly rich history of movements for democracy going back 125 years, there is a wide array of opinions, and that's how it should be. I mean, that's what a democracy should be, right? And so there's not one group outside Iran who may be organizing or leading protests or waving this or that flag that represents all Iranians, whether inside or outside Iran. And I think Iranians should be given the space, both again inside and outside, to determine for themselves what that society is going to look like, no matter what shape the government takes.
Yeah, that's important to keep in mind, because as is the case, you know, with many stories of migration, it depends on when you immigrate to the United States, under what circumstances do you immigrate to the United States. And even though there have been solidarity demonstrations around the world, including in California, in Roseville on Sunday, outside the Roseville Galleria, in support of Iranian protesters, within these demonstrations, they don't all have the same message or the same views of what they think the future should be for Iran.
Right. Exactly. And I also think one thing that might get lost, and sometimes is, this might be an unpopular thing to say, but it has to be said that there, among the factions, there's a small but strong vocal base of support for the current government in Iran for various reasons. And I think if we want to talk about a democratic vision for a post-Islamic Republic society, which is what's on everybody's lips right now, we have to also contend with that fact. We have to contend with the role that these people would play in a democratic society, rather than being sort of in denial about this particular segment existing. And by the same token, there are also some folks who would like to dismiss the protests as completely the product of foreign agitation, which unfortunately the Trump administration and the Israeli government have both put out public messages that add fuel to that kind of narrative, which only helps the regime. And I think it muddies the waters in ways that make it very difficult for us to be realistic about a viable path forward. It's, again, I would defer to Iranians to make space for themselves to decide what their society should look like. And as a member of the Iranian diaspora, I have very strong feelings and very strong opinions about what that should be. But I don't live there, and I was born here, and I don't think that I should or any of us in the diaspora should really be kind of leading the charge on what that should look like.
Yeah, those complexities played out over the weekend. I mean, in Los Angeles, there was, you know, the image of a right. U-Haul truck driver going through a crowd that was demonstrating in support of a regime change over the weekend. But according to the LA Times, that vehicle had a message reading, "No Shah, no regime, USA, don't repeat 1953.
Right.
So even within, I mean, what you just unpacked, I mean, that even happened, you know, in a very visible way, in
right.
a dangerous way
right.
over the weekend.
Yeah, just a couple of days ago. There were initial reports that the truck driver had plowed through these people unprovoked. And then another video came out showing that those protesters who were on the ground had been beating on the truck's windshield and broken the windshield with the sticks that hold their flags. There's a lot of there are a lot of different factions outside of Iran, and a lot of them really dislike each other. The primary outside of the country, outside of Iran, the primary factions are monarchists, secular democratic activists, and Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, which the last one has a very, very small support base in Iran, but are much more popular outside of Iran than they are. But even outside of Iran, they are not exactly popular.
And do they essentially support things as is, or?
No. The Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization is very vocal about their desire to get rid of the current Iranian government, and they have been since the very beginning. They were actually one of the top targets of the clerical regime in 1979 for attacks, executions, etc. They moved to Iraq after the invasion of Iran by Iraq in 1980, and then attacked Iran from bases in Iraq, which is one of the reasons that they have lost support inside of Iran. So in Europe and in the United States, this organization has had very robust lobbying efforts, and they have strong relationships with top officials in European Parliament and in the Trump administration, actually. Rudy Giuliani, John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, all of them have either headlined Mujahideen-e-Khalq conferences, or they have been in talks with them very openly. So there are factions that, again, this just goes back to, one, how polarized the diaspora is, and two, how robust is the debate between different visions for what Iran should look like. Again, I don't want to give this false impression that Mujahideen-e-Khalq has a lot of support. It's very little support, but it has been active for decades, and it has actually a pretty strong base in Northern California. So should be acknowledged as well.
Well, and the U.S. has been involved for generations.
Right.
So President Trump, as you mentioned, has threatened military action in support of the demonstrations. What interest does he have in Iran today?
This is a very good question. And I think not only you have to talk about the region, you have to talk about the world. And it's in part connected to Venezuela as well. You know, the first answer everyone always gives is the oil, right? But it's not necessarily that the United States needs Iranian oil. I'm sure it wouldn't mind, right? The U.S. government wouldn't mind. But one of the Trump administration's top objectives has been to sideline China. China's growth economically has surpassed the United States' growth, even though its total GDP is smaller than the United States. But it is gaining very quickly. Now, the two main sources for China to get their oil cheaply are Venezuela and Iran. So in order to kind of starve China of its cheap oil, it is very beneficial for the United States to cut off its access to Venezuelan oil. Venezuela was giving oil to China for very cheap because it's massively indebted to China. And Iran's number one oil export is to China. So these are things that you have to layer on top of the regional reality, which is that the Trump administration and Saudi Arabia are very close, and Saudi's biggest rival in the region is Iran. In fact, the Cold War between Saudi and Iran, you have to understand that in order to know anything about the geopolitics of the region.
You know, saying something in front of reporters on national television, posting it on social media is one thing for the president. But with your experience, what is the likelihood that the U.S. could intervene yet again?
You know, if you'd asked me this question 2 weeks ago, I would have given you a different answer. 1 year ago, I would have given a different answer. I think the 12-day war between Iran and Israel with the United States involvement over the summer really shifted a lot of things. I think that the likelihood of intervention right now is higher than it was a week ago. But I think the Trump administration and Iran have both expressed that they would prefer a diplomatic solution over a military intervention. I think military intervention is possible. It's certainly not off the table, but more likely we will see targeted covert operations and cyber attacks to cripple infrastructure before we see a direct military confrontation. Iran is not like Iraq at the invasion in 2003. It is much bigger. Iraq was 27 million. Iran is about 90 million. It is very well organized with respect to its kind of coercive apparatuses. So it has two tracks. It has an official armed forces track, and then it has the more unofficial, the IRGC, the Basij. And that track is also very powerful. So confronting Iran has been a very, very, very last resort for successive U.S. presidential administrations going back 20 years, because they know that it would be difficult. That doesn't mean, again, that it's off the table, but boots on the ground, I think, is far less likely than the other kinds of attacks we could see.
You know, finally, you know, we've talked about demonstrations and protests happening in Iran for the better part of 20 years. This time is different, given that stability with support when it comes to allies has been weakened in recent years. Do you think this latest uprising will be successful in that it could have a regime change, that it could overthrow the current Iranian government?
I have to answer this question very, very measured, because as an academic, I can tell you what's most likely based on my study of the Iranian revolution and comparative revolutions across the region and around the world. I can tell you what are the next steps that are possible and likely. It shouldn't be construed as, you know, me promoting any particular outcome. What we have seen thus far, to my mind, points to a more likely scenario of compromise and kind of sort of entente, an uneasy entente, rather than a full-blown collapse of the current regime. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is, at this point, we have not yet seen mass defections of the military. That's one thing that is needed in order to strongly point toward any kind of a serious regime change. Another thing we haven't seen is the fracturing of the regime itself. Elite fracturing is a necessary component. Now, there are factions inside Iranian politics, especially in the elites. There are many different people who disagree with each other, even among the ruling parties and the ruling class. But the terms of the debate are extremely circumscribed. They're very constrained between reformists and hardliners. That's what we call them, although there are others, of course, as well. Those are the dominating factions. So if the regime sees the Islamic Republic survival as only possible if they concede some ground to the reformists, then I think they'll do that before they, you know, make a last stand until their final breath, and then they fall like Bashar al-Assad. I think we'll have to see a couple of other things shift before we can say that regime change is imminent. And I haven't seen those yet, although they're not impossible.
Before I let you go in the last few seconds that we have, you would call this stops short of being called a revolution.
Right. Sometimes you can only tell if it's a revolution after it's done. We have to kind of see what the outcomes are going to be. A lot of folks really believed that revolution was imminent, and the success of the revolution was imminent in 2022 with the Women Life Freedom protests. And they were huge. And what we saw was adaptation from the regime and persisting survival. So regardless of what I want at this point, I'm reserving judgment to see what happens next. And I think it may become certainly a revolution. But at this point, I'm more concerned about what is happening to Iranians on the ground.
Sahar, as always, Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sahar Rezavi is the Director of Iranian and Middle Eastern Studies at Sacramento State. We've been talking about the escalation of anti-government protests in Iran, which are entering their third week and have sparked solidarity demonstrations around the world, including here in California. Up next, Visit California will join us with a travel forecast for the new year, as well as how important tourism is to the overall economy. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.